Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is Corky Siegel, a legend in the world of blues and harmonica and piano, and just a fascinating guy with a wonderful background. Corky Siegel, With Respect, we'll be right back. Corky, how are you this morning?
Great. How are you doing, John?
I am absolutely fantastic, and it's good talking to you. I'm impressed with not only your music, but listening to the various kinds of the wide range of things that you perform, but also your background. So I want to start right off with the question I ask everybody here first off, and that is, where are you from originally?
Originally, I am from Chicago.
Uh-oh. Now you've got to answer the question, Corky. This is an important question.
Okay.
Are you a Sox fan or a Cubs fan?
Yes.
And you're also a politician, I see.
Absolutely.
Well, you know that I've got to be one or the other, and I'm not going to tell you which. My listeners know who I'm for.
Just like Cubs fans and Sox fans. Politicians will go down with their team.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
Regardless of the American people.
Well, you know, I've never heard a better response to that question when I ask people than the one you gave, because it is so neat. It settles the issue. Whereabouts in the city were you raised?
Originally the South Side.
Good.
And then I stayed on the South Side. Actually started performing on the South Side while I was living on the South Side in my parents' house.
Yeah.
And lived with my parents for quite a while, even after I went on the road. It was quite a while before I actually moved to the North Side.
Mm-hmm. What about, we're in the South Side, because we have a lot of Chicago listeners.
Okay.
And people out here.
Specifically, 800 South, we called it 8,000 in those days. 8,000 South Euclid Avenue. And Euclid was a block west of Jeffrey, which when you run up Jeffrey, it ends up becoming Lakeshore Drive.
Corky, you were raised 7 blocks from where I lived.
Where'd you live?
I lived in 73rd and Oglesby.
Oh yeah, of course.
So
I hung out there.
Yep, that was a great neighborhood. Now we lived there only a short part of my life, and we moved out. My parents moved out to the suburbs many years, and then I went to school all around the country, and finally settled here in Western Michigan.
And now I'm going to school all around the world.
All right, when did you get interested in music?
I think I always have been interested in music. And actually, to tell you the truth, I think everybody is interested in music. And then some people come along and they try and convince us not to be interested in music. But I was lucky.
You didn't listen.
Yeah, I just remember playing that little spring on the door, the door stopper. You know,
yeah.
I just loved that. I just loved it so much. And, you know, in those days, when you're just a little one, we don't, and I say we meaning everybody, we don't see a painting. We don't hear music. We go inside the painting, and we play inside the painting, and we go inside the experience of music and play in the experience of music. So we just go in there. You know, it's nonverbal. It's just an experience, and it's deep and profound and completely uplifting. And then I think at some point we try and decide whether it's good or not, and that's when we start going downhill. So, you know, I've spent a lifetime trying to get that back, you know, get that perfect experience back.
Is this why when I was younger, I know what you're saying about living inside the music. I do know about that because it was an all-enveloping thing. If I'd listened to whether it was a nursery rhyme or something on a record that my parents would be playing, you lose yourself into it.
Right.
And then when it came to words, I think it was so much easier when I was younger. Now, I don't think this is just my senile stretch I've had in the last 50 years, but I remembered words more easily. And when I started to, when I listen to an old song and I start to sing it, I have that same ability to kind of shut everything else out.
Wow, yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, of course, to change the language a little bit, we say we lose ourselves in the music. I like saying we find ourselves in the music.
Okay.
And then when we experience something similar again, we call it nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a great, great power to pull us back into that place. And so, you know, when we're little, we don't really have the advantage of that kind of nostalgia because everything we're hearing is pretty much for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
When we're older, of course, and we hear something that we heard when we were young, and we had that very deep experience of finding ourselves in this music, in the experience of the music, we get this thing we call nostalgia. And what's really amazing to me is the power of nostalgia. So some people just aren't going to be able to relate or love a piece of music unless there's that nostalgia in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be the exact same piece, but there could be familiar little melodies or a familiar instrument or familiar sonic experience that just pulls you right in there. It's really quite amazing. And I when people say, how come they don't write the songs like they used to? And I say, because they can't.
Well,
I got off the track there.
No, that's all right. That's the doorstop was the first sound we talked about, and the twang.
Yeah, the first instrument. I think my first instrument, yeah.
Yeah, and what after that? I mean, I know that you're not playing doorstops these days, but it's...
Well, I am a little bit, especially at the Acorn coming up. I'm going to do a doorstop piece.
Well, let's talk about that. You're going to be coming to the Acorn on Saturday, September 10th,
mm-hmm.
8 o'clock mm-hmm. p.m., and it's going to be a solo show, but you've got somebody with you.
It's going to be 7 solo shows.
Okay.
No, it's going to be my chamber blues ensemble.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, it's chamber blues, and it's chamber blues just essentially is a juxtaposition of blues and classical, where both blues and classical are happening at the same time, but they both maintain their character. And, of course, there's a whole spectrum of possibilities where the string quartet and the East Indian tabla, blues piano and blues harmonica, become more of a blues band, and that happens now and again. And then there's times when it becomes more of a completely classical ensemble. But the most fun for me, well, of course, doing it all is the most fun for me, but if I were to pick out particular works that I've written, the ones that I love hearing or doing or experiencing are the ones where you can hear the classical and the blues actually living with each other, not blending, and complementing each other in very unusual ways. I love it. And the interesting thing about chamber blues, it's extremely tonal music for the most part. I mean, I use triads, which are hardly used in music anymore, because we've gone so far.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hear me use a chord extension like a ninth, mm-hmm. it's like, wow, you want to jump out of your chair because it's like shocking.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
within this concept of this very tonal, simple music that we present, I mean, it's not simple, it's very complex in terms of a lot of things that are going on, but in terms of the harmonic structure of it, it tends to be pretty simply put forward. In the context of a whole show of this very tonal music, we're doing one piece that is actually an improvisation. That is the doorstop piece, where it's more sound than it is melody.
Mm-hmm.
12-tone, atonal explorations, but it only lasts 4 minutes. And strangely enough, the times that I haven't done this work or anything like it in a long time, but when I've done it, it's been people's favorite piece.
Really? That's interesting. You know, we're used to, correct me if I'm wrong, we're used to it, the common scale is an 8-tone scale. And when you're talking a 12-tone scale, it is by itself is different. Am I falling out?
Except we're more used to a 12-tone.
Are we?
If we're listening to a lot of classical music, the progressive and modern classical music used the 12-tone scale as opposed to the 8-tone,
mm-hmm.
Which made it just sound a little bit strange. And then they went to atonal, which has no tonal center, which the idea is to try and pull yourself away from that, not only atone, but even using the 12th tone, you want to not try and feel like you're using any scale. And you try real hard to pull yourself away from that tonal center. And we're, you know, pretty much used to that to some degree. And we hear it too in modern jazz and progressive jazz and the like. So it's not that we're not completely unfamiliar with it, but it doesn't mean that we get that nostalgic experience.
What do you, Corky? What do you mean by
from
pull
some of it? But
yeah, what do you mean, Corky? When you say pull away, we're trying to pull away. What do you mean by that?
Oh, pull away! Hop in the car and drive.
Let's see.
And leave it behind.
By that, you're saying this is so, it grabs you in strange ways, and you just want to get away. Is that what you're saying?
Oh no, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Let me rephrase that. As a composer, when you're writing the music,
mm-hmm.
and you want to write something really progressive, really unique, and really modern, one way of doing it is trying to completely get away of the very, very common uses of the 8-tone scale or even the 12-tone scale and the harmonies that follow. So you try and do things really that one may call insane or crazy.
Mm-hmm.
However, just maybe to get off the track of your question a little bit, what I find is for myself is I don't try and do that specifically when I write. What I try and do is try and find out what my heart, what my cells, what every part of my body feels good about, and what's going to make me happy, and what's going to make me experience joy and passion and all those things, and that's what I write. And I don't think about whether it's in the box or
mm-hmm.
outside
mm-hmm.
of the box. In fact, I don't think the box is really even relevant. I think what's more relevant is if you can find who you are and what you do and follow through with your individuality, your mind and your body then is connected to what you're doing very intimately. But if you try to do something, quote, different, or if you try to do something original, or if you try to do something like other things, or if you try to do something that's popular, or if you try to do something that's this or that, you're sort of projecting outside of yourself, and you may not be as connected to that composition or performance as you would if you just went with your heart
and let go
with what you feel. So I'm just, that's what I've been trying to do. And to tell you the truth, it's been very, very difficult, but extremely rewarding.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Corky Siegel. He is a chamber blues and all different kinds of blues musician. He'll be at the Acorn Theater on Saturday, the 10th of September at 8 p.m., and will be performing with the Chamber Blues Orchestra, group. We'll be right back. Now back with Corky Siegel, a blues musician of many years, and coming with the Chamber Blues Orchestra. I keep saying orchestra.
Why? That's okay.
Because I'll tell you why in a minute. But anyway, he'll be here on September 10th at 8 p.m. at the Acorn Theater. All right, now I'm going to tell you what it was, Corky. I keep saying orchestra because one of the pieces that I listened to on YouTube of yours was a piece that you did with an orchestra. Your group, or two or three of your group, were performing with a full-blown symphony orchestra. And when you talk about coming in and out of the classical mode, the blues mode, and whatever else you've got there, it was a fascinating thing to listen to. So, and I've got that orchestra concept, which is what I want to talk to you about anyway.
And by the way, you should know that piece was written by William Russo for Siegel Schwall because of Seiji Ozawa, my meeting with him in 1966. Where were you in 1966?
I know.
So from 1966, it was finished in 1968. Was first performed with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in 1968, and then, you know, went on from there. Invitations from the major symphonies all over the world, and recordings on Deutsche Grammophon and everything. So that's where you heard that piece, and that's why you called Chamber Blues an orchestra. And
yeah,
it's fine to call it an orchestra. I think one of the things that define a chamber group is that every instrument has its own part. Where orchestras, there's a lot of doubling.
Yes.
Of parts, I think that's what defines it. But I don't care. I mean, I call it the Chamber Blues Band. I call it Chamber Blues, the Chamber Blues Ensemble. I even call it a quartet, and there's six of us. I constantly find myself calling it a quartet when there's six people in the group. So, and the other thing that I just realized during the break, I was thinking about it, in answering your questions, there's a little bit of confusion because I'm a composer,
mm-hmm,
and a performer,
mm-hmm,
and mostly I'm answering your questions as a composer, but sometimes then I switch over to the performer hat,
mm-hmm,
and I think that it creates, so I just wanted to clarify that you know, the main thing that I do in music is I'm a composer, and I compose this juxtaposition of blues and classical, but I'm actually more known as a performer.
Sorry. Walk me through. walk us through from the twang of the doorstop to the Siegel Schwall band.
Mm-hmm.
How did that all get going? I mean, did you take formal courses in music?
I love music like anybody else.
Yep.
I started trying to learn to play music, and I took some lessons on the clarinet and other things. And what happened was, I was studying classical music at Roosevelt University, and jazz, classical saxophone, tenor saxophone, classical. And also, I was trying to learn jazz on the saxophone. And my whole world of the spring was not just hearing and listening to the spring and going inside the sound, but also the physical expression of plucking the spring.
Mm-hmm.
The physical expression of plucking it and feeling the vibrations and just getting sucked into that sound. So there was something that I got caught on to really, really well, which was this concept of expression. And when I was learning jazz and classical, I was thinking, this is going to take me 10 years before I can really, really, really imbibe this material.
Mm-hmm.
And then express myself through it in a very natural and powerful way. And I just did not want to wait. You know, there's a story of this violinist who was practicing, and he would just practice one note over and over, one note over and over. And his wife said, you know, John, you know, why are you just playing this one note over and over? Our neighbor next door, you know, Bella, he's playing all over the violin. And John said, well, yeah, he's still looking for his note. I've already found mine. And so my story is sort of like that. When I discovered the blues, that's when I sort of got back into the expression of the little spring on the door. The blues structurally is simple. You know, it's not really any simpler than any other form of music, but the structure itself is simple and basic. And it allowed me to go in there and play a simple pattern, rhythm pattern, over and over and over and over, and find ways of expressing it and get deeper and deeper and deeper into that experience. And I was driving my parents nuts because I was playing like the same thing over and over. Boom, 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 boom. But, you know, after doing it, I was laughing and crying and just, oh, man, the goosebumps. It was just unbelievable. And I was just playing this one little phrase. And basically that's how I pursued music from that point on, is I wanted the experience of expression first. Then I would learn some new things. And then I would bring them in. And then I would work on those. And then I would want to feel the expression in that. And my whole development of music was based on looking for the expressive experience immediately without having to wait. And all my compositions and everything I do and everything I offer and every breath that I take that has to do with music is about where's the expression, where's the joy. And it doesn't matter what kind of music it is, or how it's written, or how it's played. I'm looking for the expression.
All right, let me go with that. What, you know, you've repeated the concept of joy or happiness three or four times,
mm-hmm.
And I've talked to people on this show and elsewhere, musicians who are fairly tortured, and what they're trying to express or the experience they've got going inside of them is a fairly sad, not just sad in the sense of blues can be sad or, you know, the moody sound, but just their angst, they have anger or whatever. You don't talk that way.
Well, it's a perspective that I don't think is really true or healthy, certainly not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, if you think about something extremely horrible and sad, and you're going to now sing about it, and you furrow your brow, and your eyes roll up in your head, would you call that feeling sad? It's deeper than sad.
Yeah, it's miserable.
It goes into the realm of what I call passion that really has no sadness. Or it's not about sadness, it's not about happiness. It's just this incredible expression, and that's why you use the word joy. Because joy doesn't necessarily... joy is just this feeling of being uplifted. And certainly if you're very, very sad or very, very angry, music is a wonderful... performing music is a wonderful way of being uplifted out of that, which is the whole concept of the blues. Is these people were so suffocated, and there was nothing they could really do, and when they played the music, it made them feel better. And so it's a little bit of a misnomer that blues is sad music. It certainly came out of sad times.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember who it was, if it was B.B. King, that said, hey, if our music was so sad, how come everyone's dancing too much? Now, of course, there's the torch music that's specifically supposed to be sad music. The topic is sad, you know.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, that's just it. I just think when people talk about emotion in music, I'd actually rather use the word expression and keep it more generic, and not say that you know that you're expressing sad or happy or this or that. You're just being very expressive and very deep and very passionate and very joyful.
Well, you know, This is fascinating because I had not ever studied the derivation in a formal sense of the blues, but I just sort of accepted the very superficial statements that I might have heard, offhanded statements that it is an expression of the difficult times that people lived in, African Americans, whoever. But I thought of it only as an expression of sadness.
Well, and you know, I'm not an expert in this, and I'm not the expert, but think about some of the lyrics and some of the blues songs.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Hoy Hoy, I'm the Boy, 300 Pounds of Muscle and Joy. You know, come on, baby, help me to spend some gold. I'm all dressed up.
Yeah.
Got no place to go. You know, I'm going to lay my head on some lonesome railroad track, and when that train starts coming, you know, I'm going to jump right back. So, you know, yeah, and you're laughing. And so there's a lot of that tongue-in-cheek, you know, with the blues. And anyway, I'm not an expert on the subject.
Okay, but is it the sound that makes blues the blues? Or is it, it's certainly not the words, because you've just pointed out that the mm-hmm. blues can be, the lyrics can be funny, they can be sad, whatever. But what is it that makes the blues the blues?
Well, you know, it just really depends. I know this is a circular answer. It really depends on how it's defined. We could define the blues in many ways. We could define it purely historically, which means that, for the most part, it has to be an African-American person
yes.
playing this music for this reason in this way. Or we could define it in purely technical musical terms, that there's a scale that is common to the blues. And when you use that scale, you're playing blues, which makes Gershwin a blues musician.
Yeah,
no one would have thought of him as a blues musician, maybe a jazz musician, but certainly not a blues musician. So, you know, it and then there's all the definitions in between which reminds me of a story.
Yeah?
That Charlie Musselwhite, the blues harmonica player, my buddy, just came up with this amazing quote. He was being interviewed on a radio show. And he was playing music with a Mexican group. And, you know, I was interested in this because not only am I playing in a non-blues group, but I'm composing the music also. So he was just simply, innocently, just saying, oh, I'm going to play the blues with this Mexican group. And the radio interviewer said, well, Charlie, but that's not being true to the blues. And Charlie said, what are you talking about? And the guy says, well, you know, the tradition, the blues tradition, you should be true to the blues tradition. And Charlie said, what do you mean tradition? When you say tradition, isn't the tradition change? Isn't the tradition change? Because if the tradition weren't change, we'd all still be beating on logs. So, you know, it's like...
I like that. That's
things
great.
Are moving too fast to try and nail everything down. I mean, it's fun to try and name things.
Yeah.
To say, this is the blues, this isn't the blues. You know, but things are moving pretty fast.
Well, we're going to take a break now, but when we get back, I want to focus on the kinds of music you're going to be playing on Saturday the 10th, and also a little bit more of how the change in your appreciation of music and your experience of music has produced a different, almost a different genre from, as you just said, those people who say, well, no, you just have to be an African-American, you have to sing about your sadness, and that's the blues. But you're talking about something else. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, but I do want to talk about the types of music you're going to be performing.
Okay.
And maybe get a little example. We're talking to Corky Siegel, Chamber Blues, and the Chamber Blues Band or Orchestra. It's a tremendous sound and a most interesting person performing. We'll be right back. Now back with Corky Siegel, who's going to be performing Chamber Blues at the Acorn Theater on Saturday the 10th of September at 8 p.m. Corky, what kind of pieces are you going to be performing?
Well, there's a certain type of piece which we call opus, and I've named the pieces opus like 14, 15, 16, 17... Opus 24, things like that. Anyway, those pieces are compositionally classical pieces that, again, juxtapose blues and classical. It would be as if a composer, let's just say Mozart, heard a blues musician on the street and fell in love. And I would guess that if Mozart heard a blues musician on the street, he would fall in love with it. So he'd say, hey, why don't you come and play with this string quartet? I'll write some music to find ways of bringing your music into what I'm doing without really changing what I'm doing and without changing what you're doing, but just having this marriage so that we really get to have fun together. You finding ways of working this blues idiom into this classical idiom and all the possible ways that it could work, the infinite amazing ways it could work. Basically, that's what that is, except the blues musician is me and the composer is me. and when I compose as someone who thinks he's a classical composer, which... it's a great advantage because I don't know any of the shortcuts. Well, so sometimes the stuff that comes out is pretty wild. I don't know that it's wild. It just sounds normal to me. But because I don't know the shortcuts and I don't know the rules of writing classical music, and all my classical music that's in my head is just based on, you know, a lot of stuff that I've heard without really studying it so much, just sort of hearing it. And then saying, okay, this is the kind of thing classical music does. This is the direction it goes. This is the sparkling joy it has to offer And then I find out how could we, you know, put that side by side with the expressive, emotional, melodic concepts of the blues. And blues is very linear, very melodic. The harmonic structure of blues is more coincidental to the melodies that are being played. It's not like the harmonies and the harmonics are planned out. They just sort of happen. And classical music is very, very vertical. You could look at any place during a piece of classical music and you could say, here's where it came from harmonically and here's where it's going. And here you could see the intention in the harmonic lines. So you have these two different ways of composing music and you bring them together and it's quite amazing. And people say, Corky, how do you do it? And I say, I don't do anything. The music does it. And you know, someday some composers are going to catch on to this. Because right now I'm the only guy that's doing it, which I'm very surprised about. You know, when William Russo wrote those first two pieces for me, we all thought, Seiji and Bill and I all thought, man, this is going to just take off. And certainly there's been some experimentation, but there's really nobody around who's devoted a career to juxtaposing blues and classical. And so right now it's dirty work, but somebody's got to do it.
Well, you mentioned you have an Indian instrument in your group.
Oh, yeah, I didn't want to be too normal.
How did that get wound in? Because we've had it, we start with the doorstop, and we're ending up
when I was writing the music, I knew that at some point I wanted to actually add in some kind of percussion. I knew it wasn't going to be drums, and there were a number of reasons. The drums are not, they're a little more than a chamber instrument because of the volume, and I thought, well, maybe I could get a quiet set of drums. But I didn't want to do that because, again, that was trap sets, you know, are one of the main instruments in popular music, and I really wanted to offer something different. So I really love the natural wooden sound. This is, when I was writing this, it started in 1983. I had just written a whole bunch of symphonic music and really, really, you know, it was just overbearing writing this stuff. And so that's when I got the idea for chamber blues. And so
well, the piece that I saw on the YouTube, I watched the director and I watched the orchestra while your group was performing, and there was one fellow there who had his hand on his on a stand or something. He was his elbow on a stand. And it was like, I want to do something here. I want to do something here, but I'm not doing anything yet. And I also then they cut to a percussionist, and I thought, well, now but where's his percussionist? Where's his? You just told me that you don't have one.
Right. So my percussion is a tabla player, where there was this wooden. Again, it was at the time of synthesizers, and I really felt the string quartet was offering something very, you know, alternative mm-hmm. in those days because everything was synthesized. And then the tabla was a perfect pairing because it has this little wooden sound, almost like different kinds of pizzicatos. So it fit very, very well into the string quartet setting, and that's how I ended up using the Indian tabla because I thought it was a perfect instrument for string quartet.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to India?
I did go recently. I toured for a month with Dr. L. Subramaniam, what do they call him, Holly? The Paganini of the Indian violin, and also Ernie Watts, the jazz saxophone player. And Dr. L. Subramaniam has a project called Global Fusion, where he actually brings jazz music into Indian music. And juxtaposes those, and I bring in, and he's invited me many times, and I am the one who brings in the blues element
mm-hmm.
into the global fusion.
When you when you are you compose blues music, yes?
Yes.
You composed, if not now, at least in the past, you composed classical music, right?
Well, I guess I'm composing classical music. I'm writing for symphonies and chamber groups.
Okay. Now, if I was to attend one of your sessions, when you introduce a new piece to your group, all right, something you've composed, which is blues, mm-hmm. am I going to find you with a full set of sheet music for each one of them in which all the parts are described, or am I going to find what? What am I going to find?
Well, mostly you're going to find, the sheet music with everything described. The only thing is I'm a little more flexible because when you have your own group, there's some of the things I don't write in, some of the bowings and some of the articulations. We take care of that during the rehearsal. I could go ahead and write them in, but then when we hear it, we may want to change it, so I figure instead of going to the trouble of writing them in, we're going to just, see how it works. But everything's written out. I could always change it. I just recently wrote a symphonic work that I've been touring with all over the world. It's a 30-minute piece, and there is no improvisation at all in it. It's completely written out. But now in my chamber group, the players are more and more learning how to improvise. And in fact, I would say at least two of them right now are improvisers. I could just throw something at them and they'll improvise and actually do an amazing job.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, instead of, if I have like Aurelian, our first violinist, play a blues solo, he'll play it in a classical style rather than in a blues style. It's pretty, it's amazing how he picked up on that.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
It's just quite...
But is this contrary to what... we have come to expect as jam sessions for jazz, where it seems that everybody improvises to their heart's content until they somehow everybody has had a chance to improvise and then they come to a coda.
Right.
Is that correct?
Well, yeah. They play the head of the piece. There's the basic melody, and then they all start improvising, and then they go back to the, they recapitulate on the original melody.
The main theme.
Yeah, but the concept of improvisation is, I think there's a different perspective in that also. And that is that when we think of improvisation, we think of just the melody and the rhythm as the main focus of the improvisation. But I really feel that all musicians improvise all the time with the other elements of music, with the dynamics, with the articulation, with the tonal variation. They could play a piece by Mozart and completely improvise because they're expressing themselves through the way they approach the pitch. There is no thing of hitting the pitch absolutely on. Sometimes you want to approach a pitch a little low,
mm-hmm.
or a little high and to express something harmonically or
to catch people's attention.
Yeah, go ahead.
When you come in a little bit of low and a little bit high, you're catching people's attention subconsciously. They're saying, whoop, that wasn't quite what I was expecting.
Right. To me, the description of a musical master, and I could think of Segovia or Yo-Yo Ma, there's a lot of musical masters, is players who can, as an expression, a spontaneous expression, vary each of the musical elements. So, again, varying the pitch, varying the rhythm, varying the articulation, varying the tonal, the dynamics, all of those. Playing a classical piece of music that still sounds like the classical piece of music, but putting their own individuality and expression into it, to me, is a form of improvisation that's
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
even more important than changing the notes or the rhythms.
Well, you've said that you perform Opus 14, 16, 24, etc. What else?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's the opuses, and the purpose of the opuses is to try to pretty much juxtapose the two forms hitting the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's other pieces that are way, way blues that even include vocals that still try and keep a remnant of the classical feel. And then there's pieces that go the other end, which I actually still call those opuses too, which are just purely classical pieces of music that utilize the blues form. But the string quartet in no way is a blues band.
So,
you know, there's this whole spectrum of possibilities, and you know, we offer that at the show. And you know, this time Sue Demmel is our guest singer artist.
Tell us about her.
Yeah, so she's this amazing player. She plays with the Sons of the Never Wrong, that I feel are the greatest folk ensemble one could ever hear. incredibly spontaneous and expressive and fun. And I sort of think of them as the modern-day Peter, Paul, and Mary. You know, taking Peter, Paul, and Mary and sort of outdoing what they did, both artistically, enthusiastically, and expressively, which is sort of hard to imagine if you were a fan of Peter, Paul, and Mary, to think someone could be more enthusiastic. But these guys are. They're amazing. So Sue Demmel is one of the three in the group, and she's coming to sing with us, do a few tunes with us on September 10th. And we got some arrangements for her that we did. We're doing this sort of R&B piece written by a friend of mine called, her name's Dorothy Scott, and the tune is called Peace Within. It's just such a beautiful tune. And Sue's going to do that, and we're going to do I'll Fly Away, a blues shuffle version of I'll Fly Away.
I love that song.
And we're going to do a piece that Marcy Levy did with us when we played the Acorn last time. Marcy is the one that wrote Lay Down Sally and toured with Eric Clapton and Aretha Franklin and had a major hit with Shakespeare's Sister.
Yeah.
So she came and sang with us a while back, and we did a piece by Solomon Burke, an R&B tune, of course a chamber blues arrangement of it, called Cry to Me. So Sue's going to do that, and she's got really an unusual arrangement. Now we're doing an avant-garde improvisation piece I may have talked about previously, and we're doing it to a movie, a 3-minute movie by this guy Ed M. Schwiller, a very avant-garde movie written in the 60s. So that should be fun.
Wild. Wild. We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Corky Siegel, Chambers Blues, bringing them together, juxtaposing them, and bringing us along with him. We'll be right back. With Corky Siegel, who will be performing at the Acorn Theater here in Three Oaks. He'll be performing on September 10th at 8 p.m., and he'll have a pretty wide range of types of music that he has composed, and he has brought his group together and is now bringing in a folk singer to be a part of this ensemble. And it sounds like an absolutely fascinating evening. Do you do folk also?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, I started out blues with the Blues Masters in Chicago in the early 60s, and then formed Siegel Schwall, which is known as a blues band.
Yes.
And then I, Siegel Schwall took a sabbatical, and I went, as they say, solo. And that was sort of the singer-songwriter scare. Where I was really a folk singer. I was really singing and writing a lot of songs.
Yeah.
I wrote 100 songs, I think, in that period. And then, and Siegel Schwall also played the folk scene. but I also played the jazz scene and this and that. So it was really hard to say that I'm a folk singer, but I did have some experiences. And hey, some of my best friends are folk singers.
Listen, I want to tell you, there's a song that has stuck in my head the last week. And it's, I thought it was something, it's performed by an Irish group, I thought.
Okay.
It's Hard Times Come Around No More. I don't know if you remember that song. It's a Stephen Foster song, I found out. It is, I can't get it out of my head. And it turns out that Bruce Springsteen and a couple of Irish bands, groups, I'm sorry, and it looks like a chamber group. One of the Irish groups performed with the chamber orchestra and sang the song. It just, it's perfect for the times that we're in, which is economic recession and sorrow and stress that is on people's lives. The reason I bring it up at this time is because it's a, the way it is performed, it really hits the times. And you are a folk singer, you perform folk music, and you talk about Peter, Paul, and Mary. And a good friend of mine was Steve Trott, who was in the original Highwayman. Listening to him and remembering those days, it's amazing to me how a genre of music can hit at the right time and it becomes the expression of the times, or a song. And I listened to your music and I thought, you know, this is a good time for that genre of music. But you've been doing it for, all right, how many years? Come on, Karki.
Well, the first time I started talking to Seiji about this, and it was his idea, and his fault, it was in 1966. And like I say, we finished the first piece in 1968, and with William Russo as the composer.
That sounds like it's about 43 years, Corky.
Yeah. And people have been telling me constantly that my time has come.
Yeah?
But what they didn't know, it was already there. That my time is coming.
Why do you keep... All right, stop for a minute. Corky, why do you keep this up? Why? I mean, you have got to have performed how many thousands of times? How many thousands?
Yeah, exactly.
How do you keep fresh? Why do you keep doing it? What is it about this world of music making and composing and performing before live audiences or microphones? What keeps you going?
Well, when you realize that you pull back on the doorstop, the spring doorstop. And in that experience, you find yourself. And then every time you experience something like that, you keep finding yourself. It's, there's nothing like it in the world, and music really offers that. And there's no way I can stop. And, you know, in understanding the importance of expression in this experience, I actually studied expression. I contemplated it. I experimented with it. I experimented with students. And I eventually found a path, a short and simple and accessible path to expression. That I utilize in my performances and in my writing, and it just makes, I could play the same piece 1,000 times, the exact same piece 1,000 times, and never get tired of it, because I found a way of keeping it spontaneous no matter what, and keeping it fresh, and keeping it feeling like it's the first time I ever played it. And it has nothing to do so much with improvising the melody or the rhythm. It has to do with the, you know,
your soul.
Varying. Well, that's true. But you know what I wanted to do when people said, "Well, you know, it's a," I said, "Well, you know what? It's a feel thing. It's a feel thing. It's the soul. Either you got it or you don't." And I wouldn't accept that. I that was just, you know, like you said in the beginning of our conversation, you know, that's a standard, you know, statement, and you tend to believe those. But I always, when I heard the standard statement, just automatically considered the opposite. So many times I found out the opposite was more true than the standard. So I just found that a very, very mechanical. I mean, actually, I wrote a book about it. The book is on my website, and it's called Let Your Music Soar, and it's about the importance of dynamic, the dynamic element in music. That is so important. I mean, everyone knows it's important, but what I've found in my 40 years of doing master classes all over the world is so few people realize how profoundly important it really is, and allowing us to deep ourselves in the experience of music and keep it spontaneous and fun.
Well, before we run out of time, Corky, I'd like you to give us an example. Do you have an instrument there that you could give us an idea of what we're talking about and what the audience might hear?
Okay, well, I'll give you a quick example of the expressive technique.
Okay.
Using dynamics. So, and then, rather than putting the phone down and talking again, I'll just keep playing for a little bit. And
I will segue out. And thank you very much for your time. It's been a fascinating discussion with you, and I hope that everybody gets a chance to see you in person at the Acorn Theater, Three Oaks, Saturday the 10th of September at 8 p.m. Thank you, Corky.
So I'm going to give you an example of no dynamics, and then I'm going to add the dynamics, and you should notice the change in expression without me changing anything else, and then I'll just continue on.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you, Corky Siegel. Remember, September 10th, 8 p.m., Acorn Theater. And remember, the name of our show is With Respect. We're on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. Until then, remember, our theme is this. If you show respect to other people will show respect to you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much, Corky.